This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
He brought back!
Mr. President, it is not only possible, it is essential. That is the whole idea of this machine, you know. Deterrence is the art of producing in the mind of the enemy the fear to attack. Is that the whole point of the doomsday machine is lost if you keep it a secret. Why didn't you tell the world, eh?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Popcorn Culture with Lynn Sharmila and Arvin. It is Throwback Tuesday ahead of our Bond extravaganza this week. So we thought we would go back in some ways to the roots of James Bond, nuclear worries, you know, supervillains and the like. And we are taking it back to 1964. And this is a long title, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
Dr. Strangelove is such a great throwback, and I'm so excited that we got here. It's one of those movies that I find very difficult to recommend to people because it's very difficult to tell people what it's about. You'll probably know about it because it's always in those lists of top 10 best films of all time, or, you know, Stanley Kubrick made it, and for all of those reasons. And that can either be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on what kind of movie goer you are. But I think this is one of those movies that even if you don't like Atta cinema, it's worth giving a go just to see how playful Kubrick and Peter Sellers, who's like the mainstay of this film, can get with a topic that's actually really not playful at all.
Yeah, so this is my first time watching this. It's something that I wanted to check out for like a long, long time. I love that you said Atta cinema, because that was my impression of the movie before with the title and the whole the Dr. Strangelove thing, the themes of like a nuclear holocaust or nuclear warfare and stuff. I didn't think it, I felt like it wasn't that at all. Like, it's so funny. I love the movie. It's hyper rewatchable. Like, I could watch it like once a week if I wanted to, because of how short it is. I want to ask though, like, what happened to Stanley Kubrick at this point? Like, how did he go from this to The Shining and 2001 A Space Odyssey? Like, where did the comedy go? Like, something must have happened in between, right, for him to have gone from this to like complete full-blown existential crisis and reality of the universe stuff.
Actually, the weird humor of Shining reminds me a lot of Dr. Strangelove, but sort of dialed to crazy.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot about this that's very Kubrickian. Is that what we call it? In terms of the attention to detail, in terms of the aesthetics, the way that the camera moves, the way in which the effects are played out. But I think that certainly the level of humor is rather unique among his works. Perhaps this is the funniest, I think. I will say that this is a perfect film, or a near perfect film. It truly is fantastic. And it tells one story of a potential version of the Cold War, in which you have a general ordering a nuclear strike on Russian soil, undermining the president in the process through systems that they themselves built into place, and triggering a doomsday device on the Soviet side. And that's more or less it. But it does play out in a few different settings. So you've got the war room, with frenzied phone calls to the Russian premier. You've got a B-52 on its way to Russia and cut off from the rest of the world with no ability to clarify to these people what's actually happening. And it's also something of a locked room drama, because there's one entire sequence that takes place in a locked room with said unhinged general and his counterpart from the Royal Majesty's Air Force, from the Air Force. And that's that is it. I loved it so, so much. Worth saying that Peter Sellers plays three roles.
Yes. And, you know, I didn't know this until a long time after I'd watched the film. Kubrick didn't even necessarily want to have him play those three roles. It was one of the conditions imposed by the studio, because Peter Sellers was such a big name and he had made a name for himself playing multiple roles in films like Lolita. I'm amazed, because this movie would not work if it hadn't been for Sellers doing those three absolutely different but equally amazing madcap roles, right? And I think I knew too much about the movie even the first time I watched, so I knew which roles he plays. But yeah, they're so distinct. If you didn't know it was him, and you know, we live it removed enough from Sellers that we don't immediately recognize him in disguise. I love the way in which these characters, which are both kind of OTT and satirical, but also really remind you of leaders and actual people in power that we know today.
I'm going to admit that I didn't know it was the same person until after watching the movie and then like going to IMDb, and then all three characters were listed under the same name, like Peter Sellers. And I'm like, that can't be right. And then I thought about it and I was like, oh, because I was thinking like there are so many good performances in the film. And then I found out that it's all the same person.
Like, who are all these actors? I never knew who they were.
It's all Peter Sellers. It's so cool. It's so cool. Like the way they did that in this movie. I love the humor. I love how dry the humor is. I love how like witty and the levels of sarcasm are just like off the charts. There's no fighting in here. This is a war room is like my favorite line. It's like the best thing. But also at the same time, it's so overtly well-researched. Like the themes are very, very heavy. The themes of warfare, of nuclear holocaust. I read that when the movie came out, it was thought of as like Soviet propaganda because of how it sort of blamed the US and their non-contingencies in events like this. So it's not a film for comedy's sake. Like it's something that Stanley Kubrick did a lot of work for. Like he spoke to people in the field and then he came out and he based this on a book, right? So it is a film with a lot to say, and he's not hiding what he wants to say at all.
And that's why there are so many disclaimers. There are extensive disclaimers all over the film. In fact, it starts with the thing that you usually see, you know, kind of tucked at the end saying, you know, any similarities to persons real or dead, etc. Except that this one is so explicit that it almost makes, or it doesn't almost make, it makes the reverse point. When you read the disclaimer, you're like, ah, I see. So this is about loads of people. And this is about real life. And it definitely has that feel, you know, that point about, I think that what's great about it is that it probably, you can't make satire this rich and rewarding if it isn't completely committed to exactly how dark it can get. And also if it isn't so true to form, in the sense that you're like, yeah, this makes sense that it would be, the war room would be like this, especially if you have a General Buck Turgidson. You know, it makes a lot of sense that this is how things would be with a Major Kong, you know, manning a B-52 and desperately trying to ensure that, heck yes, we bombed the Russians.
And Jack D. Ripper.
Jack D. Ripper, yes.
What did they expect?
Also, the president is called Merkin Muffley. I'm not going to explain what that means, but look it up. It's worth it.
Merkin Muffley made me happy. Colonel Bat Guano made me really happy. And so there are all these things built in. And I think that it is the commitment to the story and to the perversions of the story and how perverted it wants to get that that makes it such a worthwhile watch, because it packs everything in. Basically, the jokes or the observations are made a mile a minute. It happens in the script. It also happens in terms of visual cues. And when it's packed like that, it's just, oh, what a delight.
And, you know, you can enjoy it on a very, very superficial level, right? You don't need to read into the machinations of power or the dangers of paranoia or, you know, having a small group of powerful men make most of the decisions for the rest of us. You don't have to think about any of those things. You can just enjoy the physical comedy. You can enjoy the verbal repartee. You can enjoy the just hilarious performances by, well, Lieutenant Kong, for one, who's played by Slim Pickens. But also Turgidson. Like, some of these performances are so funny. But it also kind of stays with you, because if you want to, and if you want to focus on the underlying critique that the movie is making about foreign policy, about politics, about relationships between governments, there's so much there. And it's all made with this this sort of very astute touch that even decades after the Cold War has ended, we can still see shades of that and how it may apply to decisions that are made today.
And I think, like, if you want to get into it, like, you know, how accurate this film was and the stuff that it was trying to say, there is this article from the New Yorker from 2014 and how real it got like a decade later. So reading that article, now I know more about nuclear bombs and thermonuclear holocaust, and also the security sort of like measures that are put in place when it comes to nuclear bombs, something that I didn't know yesterday. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot just by watching this movie.
This film is a classic laugh to keep from crying kind of film. You know, that's the pitch of the humor. You watch it and you laugh because you know that these people are stand-ins for people who existed, but also stand-ins for people who continue to exist. That is the scary part. You watch it and you can see the counterparts. You can even hear echoes of the arguments that are being made in the war room still today, till now. And so it's like, it has that level of bleakness where you know that mutually assured destruction is a thing. It is something that was built into Cold Warfare. And yet at the same time, if you don't laugh, what is there to do? Hence, how I learned to stop worrying and love the bomb, the second part of the title, which is what we're talking about today. We're discussing Dr. Strangelove, which came out in 1964. This is our version of a lead in to James Bond, which we're reviewing tomorrow. But let us know, have you watched this film from Stanley Kubrick? You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
Mandrake. A decision is being made by the President and the Joint Chiefs in the war room at the Pentagon. And when they realize there is no possibility of recalling the wing, there will be only one course of action open. Total commitment. I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Hello, everybody. You are listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Sharmila and Arvin. And today we're talking about Dr. Strangelove from 1964, and just going on and on really about how much we loved it. I wanted to come back to Peter Sellers because we touched on him earlier on. And I think one of the things that, like I said, makes this movie feel rather perfect is that you don't even notice, it doesn't feel gimmicky when he's doing all three roles. And part of the reason it doesn't feel gimmicky is also that they didn't bend over backwards to make the visual language fit in. Nowadays, you'll see people showing, you know, shooting from the back or doing all sorts of things. But this movie actually makes it feel rather natural.
The camera is actually weirdly unobtrusive in most scenes, right? Like even the war room or, Peter Sellers plays Dr. Strangelove. And that's probably one of the most gimmicky characters, if it could have veered that way. But yeah, the camera and the way he's shot makes it feel very naturalistic. And so even the most OTT, you know, uncontrollable hand gestures that happens with the character, they all just feel off a piece. They almost feel like, well, you're in this room with this really odd character. And I think a lot of that has to do with just how much Sellers commits to each of those roles.
I also wanted to say, though, like from a very personal point of view, like my lack of familiarity with old Hollywood, like I watch those movies and I love those movies, but I'm not as familiar as a lot of people are watching these classic films, right? And not knowing that it was Peter Sellers and not recognizing Peter Sellers, for me, it's always a nice thing because I get to discover this as if it's a new Hollywood or it's a new portion of that history that I don't know of. And it's a learning process. And every time we revisit these old films that are like 50 years, 60 years old, there's something new to discover, which is an odd thing to say about an old movie, I think.
I get it. I think it's also a great way of rediscovering stardom because, again, it's very easy to feel quite distanced from your Peter Sellers or from your Catherine Hepburns, Audrey Hepburns, you know, these are some of the people that we've discussed in this context. And it's easy to think of them as types or just as Wikipedia pages. And then you watch them on screen and you're like, oh, I so get it. You're brilliant. You're really, really brilliant. And in some cases, it goes the other way. Like when you watch Benny Hill in The Italian Job, unfortunately, you know, that was less enjoyable. But in the case of Peter Sellers, you're just like, now I want to watch everything. I want to watch everything, because the level of charisma that he brings to each individual performance, and they're all very, very distinct, is something. I think it's really an odd thing to watch Merkin Muffley, the President of the United States, is on screen an awful lot. He's on screen more than Dr. Strangelove is. And you don't, I'm kind of mind blown that I did not get it. I did not see it. I don't know why.
I have a more serious point to make, but was anyone else playing Spot the James Earl Jones?
Yes.
No.
Wait. So pilot, young pilot, one of the young pilots was actually James Earl Jones.
He was the bombardier. Oh.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Once you see it, then you can't stop hearing his voice.
Watch the mouth. The mouth is everything. That's where it is.
Oh, wow. I had no idea. See, this is what I was talking about. This is exactly what I was talking about with like discovering a Hollywood that I didn't know existed. This is nice.
So the more serious point I was going to make was for a film made at that period in time, the thing I noticed this time around is how much it satirizes and takes down the idea of masculinity, because every single male character in power in this film, even the one who sort of kind of helps save the day in some ways, they're all actually just caricatures of themselves. You either have caricatures of the hapless man put in power, or you have caricatures of the warmongering like soldier who can't think beyond that, or you have caricatures of the scientist who just wants to use science to control the world. And I found that actually really interesting, because here we are today trying to reimagine what male characters could be on screen, and this film actually was already doing that decades ago.
When you say like warmongering general, the first thing I thought about was bodily fluids.
Oh my God.
It's the most disgusting way he says it. I was like, ugh. It's scary how accurate, like we spoke about this before the break, but then I also want to say it's scary how accurate this movie is about computers. I know it's supposed to be about like nuclear war and stuff. It's supposed to be about weapons, but the way they speak about computers in 1964, supposed to come out in 1963, I think this film, is weird, because it's the same problems that we are having today. I know back then it was supposed to be like a futuristic, like what if computers could decide who lives and who dies and make all these algorithms and these, you know, state-of-the-art mathematics and stuff. But today that's a thing that we do, right? We're talking about like artificial intelligence and stuff. So that was a whole other slightly existential thing for me. I was like, it's been 50 years and the stuff that they were talking about in this film is very, very real today, for better or worse.
And it kind of got there by embracing a lack of tech in some ways, because I think that the easiest way to age this film would have been to, I guess, you know, showcase exactly how limited the technology was at the time. You know, instead they make references to the big board, for example, and things like that. But you don't necessarily have to sit and watch somebody like type and, you know, watch some 1964 version of what a computer would be able to do, because of course it's true to form, right? Like it's taking place in that time and space. But I think that I don't think this was necessarily a conscious choice, because nobody then would have anticipated the iPhone perhaps, but by not showing so much of the technology, I think it managed a neat trick. You never actually find yourself thinking, wait, how come, or what is that, in a way that you might think about a more recent movie which has a flip phone, you know, where the whole plot could have been undone if they had different tech. And so because of that, all these themes that we're talking about, I think, continue to stay relevant without any visual distractions.
I think also whatever tech the film does show is actually, there's a punchline. So you mentioned the board, but also the phones, the secret cameras, like they're all there to be a sort of visual gag. Like we actually laugh at the way they are used and the role they play in all of this, and I think that also helps, because even when it looks kind of like janky and you're like, nobody uses tech like this anymore, it adds to the humor rather than sort of take you out of that space.
For anyone who's watching this or is watching it again, pay attention to the ambassador's face at the end of the film when Dr. Strangelove is doing all his weird antics. He breaks a couple of times. Like a couple of times you can see him almost break, and then they cut to like a different scene. Also, I wanted to ask you guys, like, did you read about the alternate ending that this film was supposed to have, or the original ending that it was supposed to have with like the pie fight? Should it have ended that way? Because the film does end very abruptly. It has no actual ending. So should they have left that in for some reason?
I agree with Lynn that this is a perfect film. I don't want it to be any other way than it is right now. I know there are versions of this, like apparently Peter Sellers, president, also had a much more funny and laughable version. And then they went back to the more sort of measured performance that he gives. I like this film just as it is.
Same. I did want to say, though, that in line with alternate endings, there are also stories of essentially Kubrick tricking actors into playing things a certain way. George C. Scott, for instance, who plays General Buck Turgidson and is the most OTT warmonger ever. You know, he wanted to play the role a lot more straight and true, and instead was told that he would be doing wind-up takes, you know, sort of comedic takes, just to warm him up. And those were the takes that ended up getting used. So I think, you know, the movie already pushed the bounds on ridiculousness in a few areas. I mean, Slim Pickens also almost didn't do the role because he thought it was too commie. So it's got all these weird, almost farcical backstories built into the making, such that I think a pie fight would have just put it over the top.
Actually, Peter Sellers was supposed to play the role that Slim Pickens ended up playing, but then didn't because it was an injury. He had an injury.
I only ask because at some point I would want to see that scene.
You just want a pie fight.
There, but I wanted to see like an alternate, just to see what happens, just to see what happens.
I already landed the line that there's no fighting in the war room a little early. So that was the peak. We've been talking today about Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, from 1964, directed by Stanley Kubrick, starring Peter Sellers, George C. Scott, Sterling Hayden, who we forgot to mention except in terms of bodily fluids, and Slim Pickens. We'd like to know if this is a movie you've seen, if you've enjoyed. WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Write to us at movies@bfm.my.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know where. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.